I invite you this morning to turn in your Bibles to the book of Matthew, chapter 8. We will start there before we make our way to our text over in Matthew, chapter 15. Matthew, chapter 8, though, we'll start there. Certainly appreciate so much your presence, and the Lord has blessed us again with a wonderful day to come and to offer our worship and our praise and our adoration to Him. There is no doubt that the Bible has a lot to say about the subject of faith. It describes in various places faith that is weak and faith that is strong, faith that is bold and faith that is dead, faith that is common, faith that is rich, that's abiding and steadfast, that is precious and obedient. And among those numerous descriptions of faith, we also find that there is faith that is described as being little, and faith that is described as being great. And I find it intriguing that most frequently, little faith is attributed to those who are the closest disciples to Jesus, while the phrase great faith is only ever assigned in the Gospels to Gentiles. Here in Matthew chapter 8, we find one example of that in our reading as we have made our way through, or are making our way through the Gospel accounts. This year in our weekly readings, a number of weeks ago, read across here Matthew chapter 8 and the story of the centurion who came to Jesus in hopes that Jesus would be able to heal his servant. And in the course of their conversation, Jesus says that I'll come and I'll heal him. And the centurion makes the remark that there's no need to trouble Jesus in that way. There's no reason for him to come into his house, that he is unworthy of that. Just say the word. Jesus, of course, heals the man from a great distance. And in verse 10, Jesus marveled and said to those who were following, "Truly I say to you, I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel." Make your way then over to Matthew chapter 15, because here we find the second event of this kind of description of faith in Matthew's gospel, what we have read through this month, in the month of March, in our Reflecting the Savior readings. And here in verse 28, we find Jesus describing a Canaanite woman in these terms. He said, "O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done for you as you wish." Now, in Matthew's account, that declaration of great faith actually flows out of the story of unremitting hostility on part of the religious leaders. And so in the opening portion of the chapter, we find this, the hostility, the continuing and increasing hostility of the religious leaders. And then following that, we find this outstanding and unexpected declaration of great faith, attributed to a rather unlikely source. Let's go back to verse 21 now. Let's read the text itself. "Jesus went away from there and withdrew into the district of Tyre and Sidon. And a Canaanite woman from that region came out and began to cry out, saying, 'Have mercy on me, Lord, son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed.' But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and implored him, saying, 'Send her away, because she keeps shouting at us.' And he answered and said, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But she came and began to bow down before him, saying, 'Lord, help me.' And he answered and said, 'It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs.' But she said, 'Yes, Lord, but even the dogs feed on the crumbs which fall from their master's table.' Then Jesus said to her, 'O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done for you as you wish.' And her daughter was healed at once." Now, up until this point in time, the bulk of Jesus' ministry has taken place within the Jewish regions of Galilee and Judea. But due to increasing pressure as well as increasing hostility, Jesus now ventures outside of the borders of Israel to a place that Matthew describes as the district of Tyre and Sidon. The pressure, of course, was coming from the multitudes who, as they witnessed his miraculous powers, had marked him as a prophet, perhaps even the Messiah. And they were, of course, deeply mistaken about the kind of Messiah that he had come to be. On the other hand, the hostility comes from the religious leaders who have already, by this point in time, determined to destroy him. And that threat perhaps became even increasingly so, as in the early part of this chapter, we find Jesus rebuking and embarrassing a delegation of the religious leaders who had been sent to Jerusalem by pointing out to them the ungodliness of their own man-made traditions. And so as a result of a combination of these things, Jesus, as well as in need for some physical refreshment, seeks temporary relief away from the frenzy of Galilee, away from the peering eyes and criticism of Judea. And for the first time since he was an infant, when his family fled for Egypt, Jesus now leaves the land of Israel. The region of Tyre and Sidon was to the north of Galilee. There were two cities that belonged to a region known as Phoenicia. And yet, even though the cities were on the Mediterranean coast, each of those cities would have also controlled a significant portion of territory that lay to the inland. Matthew doesn't tell us the specifics of where Jesus went in this district, but what he does tell us is that this would have been a rather considerable journey on foot. Mark, in his account, tells us that when Jesus arrives in the district of Tyre and Sidon, that he enters a house and that he wanted no one to be aware of his presence. His traveling to this region was not for the purpose of public teaching and public healing, but instead was for some much needed rest. Before long, he will have to face the cross, and so it seems that Jesus seeks at least some kind of solace in seclusion, and also a chance to supply his own disciples with some much-needed private instruction in regard to what lay ahead of them in the year to come. And yet, in spite of their efforts, Mark 7 and verse 24 tells us that he could not escape notice. And it's not difficult to imagine why he would draw such a crowd, even when he is among Gentile people. That by this point in time, here were individuals who had discovered the failures of their own pagan religious systems, that perhaps felt in some way spiritually empty. And yet, even though Jesus' first priority, as he states later in this text, is to minister to those in Israel, Jesus always extended himself to anyone who came with a receptive heart. He never refused any person, regardless of race or culture, who came to him in sincerity and faith. Those that came with evil, closed hearts typically left the presence of Jesus just as empty as they came. But those who came to Jesus seeking and sincere, even though they had empty hearts when they arrived, they would leave Jesus' presence with those hearts filled. Now, obviously, the designation great in verse 28 is a relative one. This woman's faith is not great because it's stronger or more sincere or more mature than some of those in Israel. Instead, the measurement has much more to do with proportion. Its size in proportion to the amount of light to which this woman has been exposed. When you think of the disciples, the apostles, we tend to think of them as men of great faith. And that's true. They were from our perspective. These were men, however, who had walked with Jesus for some 2 years prior to this point. They had heard the majority of his messages, and they had witnessed, no doubt, most of his miracles. They were men who had left everything behind in order to follow Jesus, and yet those advantages and those privileges were really no guarantee, as Jesus would oftentimes refer to their faith as being little. But here is a woman who was born in a pagan culture, who was raised in an evil environment, a woman who has only heard of Jesus' great power, who has only heard of his profound teaching, who only has a sense of Jesus' great goodness. And so back in Israel, you have those that had the greatest exposure to divine truth, labeling Jesus a glutton and a drunk, even going so far as to call him demon-possessed. And when he comes to the region, the district of Tyre and Sidon, and here is this woman who responds to him in this way, it must have been a very refreshing change, because she possesses a faith that moves him. Her great faith is manifested in four elements found in the text. In verses 22 and 23, we find that her great faith led her to a passionate plea. A Canaanite woman from that region came out and began to cry out, saying, "Have mercy on me, Lord, son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." But he did not answer her a word. Matthew identifies her as a Canaanite woman. She, therefore, is part of a race that dates back to some 3000 BC. Mark identifies her as a being of the Syrophoenician race. Both of those cities, significant trading centers that were on the Mediterranean coast, and thus she would have been a woman, or at least came from a culture that had traveled far and wide. And yet, even in spite of their culture, they were a lost people. In spite of her background, Matthew tells us that she seeks Jesus out. And she calls him Lord. She refers to him as the Son of David. She expresses at least some familiarity with the messianic traditions of Israel. Though she is courteous in her address, Matthew also tells us that she cried out. She pleads for mercy on behalf of her daughter. The word here speaks of a loud speech, perhaps even to the point of shouting. In other words, as she comes to Jesus, she doesn't speak to him calmly. She doesn't speak to him in an ordinary voice. But instead, the way Matthew records this is that she kept on crying out. In her plea for mercy, she's not attempting to claim something based on her own merit, but instead she's looking to receive something in spite of her own unworthiness. She comes claiming nothing for herself, but discerns the power and the ability of Jesus to do something for her in spite of her unworthiness. She says nothing of her daughter's age. She does not specifically identify her daughter's problem other than the fact that she was cruelly demon-possessed. She doesn't state how the possession perhaps manifested itself. In cases in the Gospels, we see that it manifested itself in rendering someone deaf or dumb or blind or throwing them into convulsions. But the real surprising part of the text is that Jesus says absolutely nothing to her in response. Typically, Jesus responded to any appeal for help, and in many cases actually initiates the conversation before the person ever makes a request. And yet here, what Matthew emphasizes to us is Jesus' silence, but he doesn't tell us the reason for it. Now, in the minds of the disciples, they are putting things together. And in their minds, it seems that they probably are thinking to themselves, well, it's no wonder Jesus doesn't respond to her, because after all, she is a Canaanite woman. She is not a Jewess. And therefore, in their minds, they no doubt thought that was the reason for his lack of response. But even though Jesus says nothing to her, his lack of response does nothing to curb the passion of this woman's desperate pleas. And as Matthew moves forward, he communicates that to us, not so much through the voice of the woman, but rather through the protests of his own disciples. The second element of her great faith is that it resulted in this continuing persistence. Verse 23, "And his disciples came imploring him, saying, 'Send her away, because she keeps shouting at us.' But he answered and said, 'I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.'" What you and I deem to be persistence, the disciples referred to as a nuisance. They were becoming increasingly bothered to the point that they approach Jesus and implore him to send her away. And the reason is she keeps shouting at us. Now remember the reason that they've come here. They have come to this place in search of some anonymity. And yet as Jesus continues to ignore this woman, she continues to shout after them and thus destroys their entire purpose for being there. By the way, the disciples use the very same verb that we saw back in verse 22, but they add a new element to it. And that is, they now see themselves included, that she's not just shouting at Jesus. She's shouting at them. And the idea there at the end of the verse, shouting at us, literally in the Greek, she's shouting from behind us. And so the picture seems to be that of Jesus and his disciples as they are moving from one place to another, that they don't stop or pause to deal with this woman, but instead Jesus continues to move And this woman continues to follow them from behind, and she continues to call and to cry out to them, to the point that now the disciples themselves are moved to intercede on her behalf. Needless to say, they don't appreciate her perseverance. They actually request Jesus, do something. Send her away. And yet, even though they are probably making this request out of their own prejudice against Gentiles, and thus the picture that we see here is of Jesus seeming almost more insensitive than his own disciples, because at least they have acknowledged her presence. Jesus hasn't. But even if they are moved by prejudice, it seems that what they are asking Jesus to do is simply give her what she wants in hopes that she'll leave them alone. That they are so intent of getting rid of this woman and her embarrassing noise that they implore, they now become the advocates for this woman to Jesus. And they have some merits to build on, because after all, they had never seen Jesus ever turn away a sincere request. Now, in response to their suggestions for Jesus to grant her request, you'll notice that Jesus points them to the reality of his mission. How can I do for this Canaanite what you want me to do when I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel? She's not the target audience. Jesus never viewed his time on earth as his own. He understood that he was sent here by his heavenly Father for a specific purpose, and he had devoted his entire life to fulfilling that purpose. This would have been a very powerful reminder, by the way, to his disciples, that in spite of the growing hostility that was going on within Judea in particular and among the religious leaders, that his mission was still on its course, that Israel was still the target audience, that the kingdom was still being offered first to those who were descended from Abraham. But while his words may have provided some element of assurance to the disciples, you've got to believe that it was a painful blow to the heart of this woman. In fact, in light of this kind of rejection, you would have expected her simply to throw in the towel, to give up, to respond perhaps even with bitterness. And so what's going on here? Because Jesus never in his life ever did anything unloving. And therefore his actions here must certainly have served a divine purpose. Perhaps it was the fact that Jesus had faced more than a multitude of people who were spiritually shallow, who simply pretended faith in order to get something from him, what they wanted from him. And so in order to test this woman's faith, he sets up some obstacles in front of her. The first obstacle is that he doesn't respond to her at all. He basically ignores her. The second has to do with confining the nature of his mission and his ministry to those of Israel, and she's outside of that target audience. And yet the reality is that both of those obstacles are intended by Jesus not to push her away, but to draw her closer. And we see that she responds. She passes the test. That rather than throwing in the towel or responding with bitterness, this woman, she refuses to be deterred. She is moved by an abiding love for her daughter and a determined trust in Jesus, even to the point that she faces and overcomes a third obstacle, in which case we see demonstrated her faith in her great humility, verse 25. But she came, in spite of what Jesus had just said in terms of his mission, she came and began to bow down before him. It seems there was a distance between them. She now closes that distance, comes into his presence. Jesus and his disciples have stopped. She bows before him, and her body language expresses the deep reverence that she has for her. And in that position, she utters her desperate plea in the simplest of terms. Lord, help me. But notice Jesus' answer. It is not good to take the children's bread and to throw it to the dogs. He takes what he had just stated back in verse 24 And he rephrases it with different terminology. He now takes the same image and he applies it to family life, which on the surface sounds incredibly harsh to modern ears. He makes the point that the children's bread is only to be used for the children. It's not to be thrown to the dogs. The word good here, by the way, in the Greek speaks of that which is right, noble, fair, honorable, proper. The word take in the original meant to take away or to deprive. And thus what Jesus is pointing out in his statement to her is the injustice that is committed if children who are the most helpless members of any family should be deprived of food that is due to them in order to feed an animal. Dog is another interesting term here in the text. Typically in the ancient world, dogs were not domesticated. They were strays that roamed wild in packs. They were large, mangy, vicious mongrels that scavenged through the garbage in search of food. But that's not the word Jesus uses here. Instead, the word that Jesus uses here for dog is found only here in Matthew's account and only in this parallel passage in Mark's account. And it referred to a little dog, a puppy, a household pet that was treated as part of the family. Now, even though that takes a little bit of the edge off of the insult, it's not exactly a compliment either, is it? The woman knows that children meant Jews and dog meant Gentiles. And she acknowledges, she understands that it is true. You don't give food that is intended to be given to children and feed it to the dogs, even if those dogs happen to be your pets. Animals need to be fed, but they don't need to be fed at the expense of your kids. Now, the one element that we don't know here is how Jesus said it. One of the pitfalls of the written word is that it presents certain challenges in terms of tone or body language with which the words are communicated, unless, of course, that is contained in the text. And it's not here. We understand that, you know, that I can call a dear friend of mine a jerk, say it with a smile on my face, and even put a little bit of affection on it. It's all in the matter of how I say it. Now, does Jesus utter these words with compassion in his eyes? Is there a particular intonation in his words that help to rob them of, or at least diminish the insult or the injury? It seems to me highly likely that Jesus did not use that phrase in a way that many of his Jewish counterparts would have used it when they referred to Gentiles as dogs. Now, whether it was the way Jesus said it or the look that was on Jesus' face when he said it, we don't know that. What we are told is that this woman takes the very same metaphor that Jesus used and she employs it to emphasize the fact that even little dogs have a caring relationship with their master. In humble perceptivity, this woman acknowledges Jesus' mission to go to Israel first. She doesn't argue with that point. She understands that was his mission, that the needs of the children must be met, that the care of animals, of dogs, even household pets, should not interfere in any way with that necessary duty. But, she says, but, she says, yes, Lord, but even the dogs feed on the crumbs which fall from their master's table. Lord, that's not the whole story. The little dogs that belong to the household, they have their place too in the family. They are allowed to eat the scraps that fall from the table. There's an unwritten rule in most houses that if it's on the floor, it belongs to the dog. And Tim and Amanda's dogs are very grateful that Caitlin is a part of their family. One writer stated it this way, she caught him in his own words. She simply stakes her claim on the conditions that Jesus himself has just formulated. I'm not demanding a spot at the table. I'm not looking for a portion of food that was due to the children. Instead, in genuine humility, she declares her contentment to accept her place in the household that she has been assigned. I'm the family pet. I'm the little dog. But even that little dog is a member of the family and enjoys certain privileges. She doesn't presume on a position she doesn't possess. She doesn't, instead, she looks to take advantage of what Jesus has just acknowledged the place for her to be. She's a household pet. And more than that, she verbalizes her deep trust in the fact that Jesus only needs to supply just a small crumb to heal her daughter. Here's one of the very few occasions in the gospel accounts where someone engaged in a verbal jousting session with Jesus and kind of comes out on top. She sort of takes what Jesus says and turns it on him. We've seen Jesus do that a number of times with others, that he takes questions or statements and he turns it to his advantage. And here this woman does much that same thing. And Jesus notices it. And he commends her for it. Jesus said to her, "O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done for you as you wish." And her daughter was healed at once. He begins by putting up a wall of silence. He then puts up a double wall of rejection. And in response, Jesus hears from her what he was hoping to hear. A seeking heart that simply would not give up. She's sort of like the Gentile version of Jacob, who back in the book of Genesis wrestled with an angel and said, "I will not let you go until you bless me." That's sort of the way this woman is. And you'll notice it's interesting. Jesus doesn't commend her for her persistence, though she was persistent. Doesn't commend her for her humility, though she was humble. He targets her faith. And he declares her faith to be great. It's the first word in the original. Thus it isn't in place of the emphatic. Matthew is stressing that element of this woman. She believes in Jesus, and in the end she obtains what she sought. Matthew says that her daughter is healed immediately. Mark, in his account, chapter 7, verses 29 and 30, he said to her, "Because of your answer, go. The demon has gone out of your daughter," and going back to her home, she found the child lying on the bed, the demon having left. And just like the account back in Matthew chapter 8 of the centurion's servant being healed, we find in both of these accounts that the request comes on behalf of someone else, that the healing takes place at a distance. Jesus is not in the immediate presence of either one of them. And in both of them, there is this commendation of a Gentile possessing great faith. Now, in the mind of this woman, she's just received crumbs that fell from the table. In comparison to the things that Jesus had performed throughout the nation of Israel, they were crumbs. But those crumbs were a veritable feast for this woman and her daughter. Though she never heard the Sermon on the Mount, she manifests some of the qualities upon which Jesus had focused so much of his attention in that sermon. She kept asking until she received. She kept seeking until she found. She kept knocking until it was opened to her. And amazingly, here's this Gentile woman who lives outside of the nation of Israel, who demonstrates one of the clearest understandings of God's plan of salvation, Jesus' mission, and his part and his participation in that mission. In many ways, she shows up many an Israelite. And in particular, shows up many a Pharisee who earlier in this very same chapter approached Jesus in hostility to argue with him as to whether his disciples should be washing their hands before they eat their meal. And by Jesus' response and his actions in regard to this woman, he shows his disciples and he shows us that there will be the ultimate ingathering of all peoples and all nations who exhibit the kind of faith that this woman exhibited. The kind of faith that moved Jesus. This morning, do you believe? Do you have faith? But not just some kind of mental acknowledgement, but a trust. A trust in who God is, who Jesus is, what Jesus came to do, what Jesus did, what Jesus accomplished, what Jesus offers. This morning you need to obey the gospel. You need to come to Him in faith and receive the greatest gift that anyone can receive, eternal life. What we find in the book of Acts is that people who responded to the gospel believed, but they didn't just believe. They repented of their faith, repented of their sins, that their faith moved them to do something. That they confessed that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of the living God. That they were immersed in water for the remission of their sins. And that when they came up out of the water on a number of occasions in the book of Acts, we find those people went on their way rejoicing. If we can help you to do that very thing this morning and leave here rejoicing because you're now connected to the King, we'd love the opportunity. Would you make that need known while together we stand and sing?